I have a challenge this morning. For those of you who like statistics, this is going to be a really interesting lesson. For those of you who don't like statistics, you might want to go to the back and get a cup of coffee so you can follow along. I don't know. So, I think it's important because, I'll tell you what, this is a political controversy that's not going away. It's the controversy about global warming. And so I want to give an overview of the global warming controversy and see if you can have at least some understanding of what it's all about. All right? So, here we are, a four-page outline, Clyde and Elaine and Lauren and Pat, I don't know who copied all these, but that's a lot of work, and thank you. Clyde, I have a copy of the outline for next week that I need to give you before. You got it because of the email. Okay, good. Well, I'm going to go through the whole thing in overview to show you where we're going before I start on the details. So, global warming and carbon fuels. Point A, Earth's atmosphere brings both warming and cooling influence. And I want to talk about how that works for a little bit. Then go over to the next page. In a little bit above the middle, it says point B, the Bible's teaching about the Earth. So first I want to talk about the atmosphere in general, and now I want to talk about what does the Bible say about the Earth. And then over to the next page three, the top, second line of page three, what does the scientific evidence say about global warming? So I want to talk about some of that. There's controversy on that. And then, point four, page four, about the second paragraph there, government control of energy equals an unacceptable loss of human freedom. The controversy over global warming is a controversy over human liberty versus government control. And I think that is a really important major point that I want to make. If government can control how much energy you use, it can control how much you drive your car, what temperature you keep your house at in the winter and the summer, how much you run your factory to produce goods, how many times you can fly on an airplane, because that's using energy. It could control how much you are able to use a truck to transport goods in your business to a store. If government can control your use of energy, it can control most of your life. So, I mean, at the bottom of this controversy is a question of freedom versus government control. And so I want to put that in perspective. So, all right, with that overview, let's go back to page one and see if we can make this interesting enough to get through the outline. All right? Page one, A, Earth's atmosphere brings both warming and cooling influence. So the first paragraph there is about warming effects from the atmosphere, and the second paragraph is about cooling effects from the atmosphere. Warming effects from the atmosphere. What's called the greenhouse effect means that the atmosphere retains the heat energy that comes from the sun. The atmosphere is made up of nitrogen, 78%. Oxygen, 21%. What if you add 78 and 21? 99. 99% of the atmosphere is oxygen and nitrogen, and it doesn't function as a greenhouse gas. The remaining 1% of the atmosphere, so, I mean, if you divided this up in 10 lines and 10 rows and 10 columns, just 1%, 99% is nitrogen and oxygen. And I'm going to draw this little box down here. This remaining 1% right down here, that's a whole bunch of other stuff. Of that 1%, 0.45% of it, that is about half of that 1% of the atmosphere, is greenhouse gases, that is, that retain some heat. But of that, 89% of that is water vapor. So he's got 10% left that's not water vapor. And the other greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, which is what all the controversy is about, carbon dioxide is 0.039% of the total atmosphere. Now, if that's 1%, then this is less than a tenth of a percent. It's 4/100ths. Four one hundredths of 1%. It's really tiny. It's right, if you can see it, it's right down here. It's a little tiny bit. Okay, that's how much is carbon dioxide. And that's what the controversy is about, okay? Not 1% of the total atmosphere. Not 0.1% of the total atmosphere. But 4/100ths. It's 4/100ths of a percent of the total atmosphere. Okay, that's what the controversy is about. Point four. Of all the warming effect of the atmosphere, 80% of that comes from water vapor, and 15% comes from high-altitude cirrus clouds. So for convenience, we can say that water equals 95% of greenhouse warming. And the remaining 5% of the warming comes, approximately 5%, comes from other things, 3.6% of it from carbon dioxide. Now, when they say greenhouse gas, it's not really a good description, because a greenhouse, you have glass that traps the air inside. But in the greenhouse effect of the Earth, the energy comes from the sun. Okay, this is my fist is the sun. Energy comes from the sun in the form of light. The Earth absorbs the light energy, and it radiates back in the form of infrared energy. So if you have a rock outdoors and you put your hand above it on a sunny day, you can feel the rock is warm. That's not light energy. That's heat energy. That's infrared. And then greenhouse gases absorb energy, infrared energy, heat, and then radiate it outward. Okay, so here's what happens. The sun hits the Earth. Let's say the sun hits a rock, and then it becomes hot. It's radiating heat outward, and you put your hand there, and your hand becomes warm. Now, let's say you put your hand on your cheek, then you feel, oh, my hand is warm from the rock. So that's your hand is radiating heat outward. And so what people are saying is the sun comes, it warms the Earth, reflects back into carbon dioxide and water vapor, and then the water vapor radiates heat outward, and that kind of warms the Earth up. So that's in a summary, what's happening. It's that heat that's radiated outward from the gas that is in the atmosphere instead of from your hand. Some of that, this is on point seven, greenhouse gases absorb infrared energy heat and then they radiate it outward. Some goes up into space and that cools the Earth. Some of it goes down to the Earth's surface and it warms the Earth. It's good for us that not all of the sun's energy stays at the Earth's surface or we would cook. I don't mean we would cook food. I mean we would be cooked. It's also good that not all of it bounces back into space or we would freeze. So that's warming effect from the atmosphere. It's not talking about the sun warming the Earth or the Earth warming things, but it's the atmosphere getting some of that heat energy and reflecting it back and it's warming. Okay, then there are cooling effects from the atmosphere. If we didn't have the greenhouse effect, the Earth's surface on average would be 0 degrees Fahrenheit and we would freeze. With the greenhouse effect, where that some of that atmosphere retains heat, the temperature is 59 degrees Fahrenheit. But guess what? Not all of that heat that's caught up in the water vapor and the other gases, Not all of that stays on the earth. There are balancing factors to modify the greenhouse effect. If those balancing factors didn't lose some of the heat, the temperature on earth would average 140 degrees. That wouldn't be very good. That would be warmer than Arizona. And we would cook. So the cooling influences are climate feedbacks. Those are changes in the atmosphere that are caused by other changes in the atmosphere. And there are a bunch of them. Like there's evaporation, and that cools things down. There's precipitation, rain, snow, dew, and sleet can cool things down. Convection, which is air going upward, and it cools the earth. There's wind or advection. In other words, weather. All that weather has kind of a moderating impact on how much the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere affects the temperature. There are other feedbacks. Cloudiness can change. It can change. And now, here's the question. Do clouds warm or cool the earth? Both. Because if you have a low cloud, it comes over you on a hot day and you're in the shade, it's cooling, right? A low cloud cools you. That's pretty obvious. We experience that. But the really high clouds up in the top of the atmosphere, they tend to trap heat in the atmosphere, and so they have a warming effect on the earth. Low clouds cool the earth by making shadows. High clouds warm the earth by keeping the heat inside. On balance, all these feedbacks, rain, snow, wind, clouds, etc., these feedbacks decrease the greenhouse effect by 58%. That's the key thing. If there was no greenhouse effect, as keeping the heat in the earth, we'd have 0 degrees. With the greenhouse effect, minus the feedback, without the feedbacks, it'd be 140, but we end up somewhere in the middle. You have the greenhouse effect and you have feedbacks, and we end up at an average of 59 degrees. That means 58% of the greenhouse effect is eliminated. The earth averages 59 degrees, but it's colder in the winter, it's warmer in the summer, it's colder at the polar regions, it's warmer in Arizona or in the equatorial regions, it's warmer, and there are other local variations, but average 59 degrees, and it's really well suited for human life. People can live in all different regions of the earth. So now, with all that about the greenhouse effect keeping, you know, trapping heat on the earth and the feedbacks modifying that so that some of the heat escapes, what is the controversy about carbon dioxide? Global warming alarmists, those people who say we need to be alarmed about global warming, they say that human activities are causing the concentration of greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, and also methane and some other things, to increase. And their increased concentration could warm the earth enough to cause significant, even catastrophic harm to people and ecosystems. Carbon dioxide is said to be the biggest culprit, and it's responsible for 3.6% of the total greenhouse effect, according to this position. Now, what is carbon dioxide? If you open a can of Coke, it goes, that fizz inside it is carbon dioxide. It's the carbonation in carbonated beverages. If you take a deep breath, you inhale 21% oxygen, you exhale, some large percentage of that is carbon dioxide because your body has processed the oxygen, and when you exhale, you give off more carbon dioxide than you breathed in. Carbon dioxide, if you freeze it, it becomes dry ice. Now, here's the key. When organic material burns, it releases carbon dioxide. So if you burn wood, the chemical reaction releases carbon dioxide. If you burn coal, oil, or natural gas, what are called fossil fuels, it releases carbon dioxide. Even if you burn wood or coal or oil or natural gas in a completely clean atmosphere, that is, you've got scrubbers to take the soot out of the exhaust, or you've got scrubbers on your or pollution control mechanisms on your car so you don't give off smog and exhaust. Even if it's completely 100% clean burning, you're still giving off carbon dioxide necessarily because of the chemical reaction. And that's what people are saying is causing the problem. In our bodies, carbon dioxide is very important in regulating our blood flow and rate of breathing. We breathe in oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide, and so do all insects and animals. They emit carbon dioxide. And it's also emitted from oceans and volcanoes and other things. But it's important because plants need carbon dioxide. Plants love it. They use it for photosynthesis so they can make energy. During photosynthesis, plants absorb carbon dioxide and they give off oxygen. So it's a really good system. I breathe out carbon dioxide. The plant says, thank you, takes it in, and then it gives off oxygen. And I say, thank you, and I breathe it back. We trade off. And God has set up the world to work that way. That's why we like to have trees and plants around to give us oxygen. So rather than a pollutant, carbon dioxide is essential to all the major life systems on the earth. Now, how much has carbon dioxide increased? According to a number of atmospheric scientists, if you increase carbon dioxide from 270 to 385 parts per million, that's what has happened since 1750, but the vast majority of it since increase has come since World War II. Well, what would be the effect of the increase? And there's some statistics that I quote in my book saying if you double it by more than 270 to 385, if you go 270 to 540, it would raise the Earth's average surface temperature before feedbacks from 1.8 to 2.16 degrees Fahrenheit. It's a very small increase. It doesn't scare anybody. Well, then why are people afraid? They believe that climate feedbacks magnify the warming rather than modify the warming. And all of the computer models used by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, assume that the climate feedbacks are magnifying the warming that comes from greenhouse gases. And so when people are saying we're afraid of global warming, that it's going to be a disaster for the Earth, these are based on predictions of future weather produced by computer models. And the computer models are set up to give different weights to different factors. And basically, the models predict whatever is required by the data and formulas fed into them. And so the fears of global warming in the future, this is really important, they rest on hypotheses represented by computer models. They don't rest on empirical observations of the real world. These models assume various feedbacks that add to the greenhouse effect. And they predict that the warming from doubled carbon dioxide since pre-industrial time would result in an increase of 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit to maybe 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit to a high estimate of 7 degrees Fahrenheit increase. Then you take some other computer models and they take the 7 degrees, the highest range, and they go on and predict serious harm from such warming. But remember, these are all just computer predictions. They're not evidence. They're merely guesses or hypotheses. Other scientists, however, and these are the scientists that differ about this, they say there's no reason to think the feedbacks will act differently on man-made greenhouse gases than on natural ones. The feedbacks currently eliminate 58% of the warming effect of natural greenhouse gases, so shouldn't the feedbacks eliminate 58% of the same amount of the warming effect of man-made greenhouse gases? And so these scientists that say we don't have to be concerned about global warming, they say that the proponents of global warming have the feedbacks exactly backwards in their computer formulas. Observing the real world, they say some feedbacks may be positive and tend to warm the Earth, but the combined feedback effect must be negative. Because we know it is, because the feedbacks that already happen mean that we don't have 140 degrees here on Earth. We only have 59 degrees average. So the feedbacks, that is, the modifying effect of retaining heat in carbon dioxide and water, the modifying effects have to be negative. And so the feedbacks will have a cooling effect on additional man-made greenhouse gases. And so they're saying if you double carbon dioxide before feedbacks and you get an increase maybe 1.8 degrees or 2.16 degrees Fahrenheit. But if feedback subtract from warming, as they always do when we observe them, that would lower the warming effects by about 58%, and the total warming of doubling of carbon dioxide would be between 0.76 degrees Fahrenheit to 0.9 degrees Fahrenheit. In other words, less than 1 degree Fahrenheit. 1 degree Fahrenheit, you can't feel that difference. At least, I don't, maybe Margaret can when I change the thermostat at home. But most people can't until 1 degree difference. In other words, doubling the amount of carbon dioxide from pre-industrial times would lead to a total warming, global warming, of less than 1 degree Fahrenheit. That's not dangerous. It's not significant at all. Is there any benefit? Oh, yes. If you have more carbon dioxide, you know who's happy? The plants are very happy because plants love carbon dioxide. And if you have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the plants grow better. They produce more tomatoes and more ears of corn, and they produce more strawberries. And you know what else? They can grow longer growing seasons, and they can grow in a little bit cooler climates than otherwise. So longer growing season in cooler climates, less crop damage from frost, fewer cold snaps, which tend to kill about 10 times as many people per day as heat waves, and longer growing season, it would make food more abundant and more affordable. So more carbon dioxide, many people think, would be a great benefit to the poor people of the world and to everybody else who would have lower food prices. Richard Lindzen is a senior climate scientist at MIT, and he wrote a study co-authored with Yong Sang Choi, which is footnoted in my book, called The Earth Radiation Budget Experiment, and he thinks there's less warming even than 1 degree Fahrenheit from this increase in carbon dioxide. Okay, so that's kind of overview. To my mind, it's very doubtful that carbon dioxide has any effect on global temperature that we need to be concerned about. I just don't think. And so you can open your can of pop and drink it and let the carbon dioxide, or drive your car or fly in your airplane and not worry about carbon dioxide increasing in any significant way in the Earth. Now, what about the Bible's teaching about the Earth? Point one, did God design a fragile Earth or a resilient one? Would an architect design a building so that if someone leaned against one wall, its structural feedbacks would magnify the person's weight? It would vibrate and vibrate and vibrate until the building just collapsed? That's not a good architect. And if God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good in Genesis 1:31, we would think that he made a very resilient, substantially stable earth. If God created the earth, it's more reasonable to think that the fundamental mechanisms of the Earth's climate system are robust, self-regulating, and self-correcting to operate somewhat like a thermostat, cooling the planet when it begins to warm and warming the planet when it begins to cool. And there's a study there by Fred Singer and Dennis Avery, Unstoppable Global Warming Every 1,500 Years, that says there are just long-term cooling and heating trends over the course of history in the Earth. And, you know, it seems to me reasonable that God would design an earth that would be self-correcting. What we have, there's one study that shows that these very high atmosphere clouds respond to temperatures in the ocean. If the ocean begins to heat up, then the high atmosphere cirrus clouds disperse and they let more heat go out into outer space. And then if the ocean begins to cool down, the high atmosphere clouds increase, and they keep more heat on the Earth. Well, isn't that interesting? And the authors of that paper called it a global iris effect. That is, just like your eyes, iris responds to changes in light. So it looks like these high atmosphere cirrus clouds expand and contract in order to maintain kind of a steady balance on the temperature of the Earth. And I wonder if there aren't other mechanisms like that that haven't even been discovered yet, that God built into the earth so as to take care of the problem that would come if we got too hot or too cold. That is, an evidence for that is these long-term patterns of when it becomes cool, then it has a warming cycle. It becomes warm. It has a cooling cycle. And these long-term patterns indicate, like, they suggest that there's some kind of self-regulating mechanism in the earth. Wouldn't that seem like the kind of stable earth that God would create? Number two, we have God's promises to maintain stability in seasons and oceans. I'll skip down to number two. In the seasons, number one, Genesis 8:22, God promised Noah, well, the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. In other words, there are going to be cycles between cold and heat, between summer and winter, but those cycles won't cease while the earth remains. Number two, God promised, never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. Genesis 9:11. Looks like there's not going to be a global warming caused flood to destroy the earth. God said there won't be. Jeremiah, God says, I place the sand as the boundary for the sea, a perpetual barrier that it cannot pass. Though the waves toss, they cannot prevail. Though they roar, they cannot pass over it. Jeremiah 5:22. Doesn't that look like God is saying, we're not going to have a flood overrunning vast regions of the earth. God put the sand as a boundary for the sea that it cannot pass. It's interesting, in the next section here, some teaching in Jeremiah that people displease God when they fail to acknowledge his control of the weather. After Jeremiah 5:22, it says God placed the sand as a barrier for the sea. Then God rebukes Israel for not acknowledging that he controls their weather. Jeremiah 5:23-25, and I'll read that. This people has a stubborn and rebellious heart. They have turned aside and gone away. They do not say in their hearts, let us fear the Lord our God, who gives the rain in its season, the autumn rain and the spring rain, and keeps for us the weeks appointed for the harvest. Your iniquities have turned these away. Your sins have kept good from you. For wicked men are found among my people. They lurk like fowlers lying in wait. Well, these people have a stubborn and rebellious heart, not acknowledging the Lord and fearing him who gives the rain in its season. That's in response to this verse that says, do not fear me, declares the Lord. Do not tremble before me. I place the sand as a boundary for the sea, a perpetual barrier that it cannot pass. Point two here, the underlying cause of fears of dangerous global warming might not be science, but rejection of a belief in God, his goodness in creating the earth and his goodness in sustaining it. Paul speaks of people who suppress the truth about God's existence and attributes in Romans 1:18-25. Such a description could be applied to much of the environmentalist movement for whom Mother Earth, rather than the one true God, is their highest object of devotion. And then I've got a whole list of other passages here in the outline that talk about God's control over the earth's weather. Leviticus 26:18-20, Deuteronomy 28:12, 23-24, 2 Samuel 21:1, 1 Kings 17-18, Job 37:9-13, Psalms 107:23-38, and 148:8, and Amos 4:7-8, and Jonah 1:14-16, and Matthew 8:26-27. Why did I read that whole list of verses when you've got it on your outline? Because there might be people listening on the tape, and there are the verses. When I was in Atlanta, I met somebody from Cape Town, South Africa, and he said, I listened to your class. So, all right. Hello, Cape Town. So we've got God's good creation of the earth. We've got a promise to maintain stability in seasons and oceans. And we've got God's control of the weather. Now, someone said to me when he knew that I was arguing this way, he said, well, can't human beings destroy the earth? I mean, can't they make atomic bombs to blow up vast regions of the earth and pollute the earth pollute the rivers and pollute the air? Yes, we can if we use resources foolishly and not wisely. I realize that we can use resources foolishly. But that's not what the global warming alarmists are saying. They're saying there is no good way to use these resources. They're saying you can't burn coal, oil, natural gas, or wood to make fires to keep warm. There's no way you can burn them because carbon dioxide is a pollutant. But it's not a pollutant. It's a part of nature, and it's necessary for plants. And it's necessary for us in regulating parts of the mechanisms of how our bodies work. So I agree that we can use resources foolishly. You can misuse atomic bombs or dump pollutants into the river, yes. But I don't think that God has set up the earth so that when we use resources wisely, we would destroy it. Do you see the difference? Let's go on to the next point here. And if you want to just put a star or an asterisk or an underline on this next point, God did not design the earth so that we would destroy it by obeying his commands. See, I think this is the heart of the question from a theological standpoint. God said to Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. God wanted Adam and Eve to develop the earth, have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, fill the earth. He made it to be inhabited, and then to use its resources. And that means using its energy resources. And the most convenient, most transportable, most easily accessible and very abundant resources on the earth for energy are wood in more primitive societies, coal, oil, natural gas in more advanced societies. Do we really think that God set up the earth to work in such a way that the more we do these morally right things, that is, building factories, driving trucks, driving cars to visit friends or go to work or come to church, the more we do these morally right things, heating your house in the winter, cooling it in the summer, the more we do these morally right things, the more we'll destroy the earth? Yes, resources can be used foolishly. I'm not advocating reckless and dangerous use of the earth's fuels. But global warming alarmists are warning against clean and safe use of these fuels. That there's no safe use of fossil fuels because even if they're burned with 100% pollution-free flames, they will still necessarily emit carbon dioxide. It's an unavoidable byproduct of combustion. They don't object to the abuse of these resources, coal, oil, natural gas, wood, but they object to all use. And so I go back to the heading at the top of this little paragraph. God did not design the earth so we would destroy it by obeying his commands. I flew back from Atlanta on Friday. Atlanta to Dallas, Dallas to Phoenix. Did I think, oh, I hate to travel this way because I'm destroying the earth by flying on this airplane? No, I didn't. I just said, thank you, Lord, that I get to travel on this airplane. It was really nice, so I can be back here. I think that's good. I drove a car this morning. I didn't say, oh, I feel guilty. I'm driving a car and burning carbon-based fuels. I'm adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. No, I didn't even actually think about doing it at all. But now that I think back on it, I'm happy that I was able to drive a car because I've ridden my bicycle from home to Scottsdale Bible Church, and it takes a long time. I don't want to take all that time, actually. And then I feel kind of all hot and sweaty when I get here. Energy saves us work, saves us effort, saves us time, enables us to do a lot of productive things, enables factories to run and farmers to harvest crops and people to take products to market. Use of energy makes life possible. It makes subduing the earth possible. Do I think that God made the earth in such a way that by doing his commands, obeying his commands, caring for our families, earning food and making products to use, by obeying his commands, we would necessarily be destroying the earth? It just doesn't make sense to me that that would happen. Am I making sense? Is this? Okay, good. Because that's the heart of what I'm saying right here, that paragraph. I talked about number 5 already. Okay, now the next section at the bottom of page 2, global warming alarmists, by making us feel guilty for driving a car or turning up the thermostat to keep warm, they remove our motivation to thank God for his gifts of cheap, abundant energy resources. The Bible praises God for his creation of the earth. Genesis 1:31, God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good, not fragile, and likely to be destroyed the more we subdued the earth. Psalm 24:1, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. And 1 Timothy 4:4, everything created by God is good. And that includes coal and oil and natural gas. Nothing is to be refused if it was received with thanksgiving. So we should give thanks and praise to God for the excellence of the earth that he created. I think you should be thinking, thank you, God, I get to drive my car and burn gas. It gets me here. This is great. Not, oh, I feel so guilty. I'm burning up carbon. I'm creating carbon dioxide and destroying the earth. Once you get that global warming fear in your mind, you feel guilty for using God's good gifts that he's placed abundantly in the earth. So next page, God wants us to develop the earth's resources because he formed it to be inhabited. Okay, that's theological perspective. Okay, next. What does scientific evidence say about global warming? Scientific evidence, scientific opinion is strongly divided about global warming. A list compiled by a U.S. Senate panel showed more than 700 scientists published rejections of whole or significant parts of the global warming hypothesis. And another list, more than 31,000 degreed scientists, over 9,000 with PhDs, have signed the global warming petition saying this isn't something that we need to be alarmed about or reduce carbon fuel use about. There's a book by a man named L. Solomon called The Deniers, world-renowned scientists who stood up against global warming hysteria, persecution, political persecution, and fraud. And, you know, I read online the story of a very well-known scientist at a major university who retired, and he said, okay, now that I retired, I can tell the truth about what I think about global warming. I mean, this is, okay. No consensus found in studies of published literature. And I've got a footnote to that. In fact, next section, the Earth's temperature has fallen or remained steady for the past 15 years, a result not predicted by global warming computer models. And I've got a chart I'll look at in a minute. But Dr. Phil Jones, he was a longtime director of the Climate Research Unit, CRU, at the University of East Anglia. Now, I want to tell about that. That's the source of world temperature data that all these studies have been using. Or it's one of the main sources, this temperature at this University of East Anglia. East Anglia is a region in England. It's actually the region that the city of Cambridge is in. So it's not too far from where I've spent a lot of my time. I've never been at the University of East Anglia, but that's kind of it's north of London, and that's kind of the area where this university is. And for some reason, they got specializing in climate research a long time ago. But this Phil Jones said that during 1995 to 2009, which is a period of 15 years, there's been a positive warming trend of about 12 one-hundredths of a degree centigrade per decade, or 0.2% of a degree Fahrenheit per decade, too small to be statistically significant. But, he said, if you just go from 2002 to 2009, a seven-year period, there's a cooling trend of minus about a tenth of a degree centigrade for the last 7 years. Such stability or even cooling in the presence of increased carbon dioxide isn't the predicted result from global warming computer models. And earlier changes from global temperatures have not coincided with changes in atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide. Okay, so now, first I want to read you a quote from this Phil Jones. He actually stepped down from his directorship of this climate research unit a year ago because of a scandal that was called ClimateGate, where all these thousands of emails and computer analyses were released, and it was found that they were cooking the books. They were global warming the books. In other words, they were rejecting data that didn't conform to their analysis, and it was just like, it was really, frankly, scientific dishonesty. And I have lived in the academic world now since, I guess, as a student from in the academic world of theology. I started seminary in 1970, so that's 40 years. But as a professor since 1977, that's 33 years. And I found something. When you find that an article or a researcher is being dishonest at one point, it often is the tip of the iceberg, and you find misuse of data or misrepresentation or not accurate, being accurate and quoting things in some other points as well. When you find one thing, you find other. And this was beginning to show a pattern of a lot of systematic misrepresentation of data. And it was the source of temperature measurements around the world. So I think it threw their credibility into disrepute and disarray. But even so, this guy, Phil Jones, who directed this place, gave an interview February 25th of 2010, just earlier this year, in the BBC. And he was asked about the statement, "The debate on climate change is over." And what did this guy who favors global warming alarmism, what did he say? "I don't believe the vast majority of climate scientists think this. This is not my view that the debate is over. There is still much that needs to be undertaken to reduce uncertainties, not just for the future, but for the instrumental past, and especially the paleoclimatic past as well." That's far in the past. So in other words, he won't say that the debate on global change is over. He said, "I don't think the majority of climate scientists think this." Very interesting. So if you hear people say, "It's all over, all scientists agree," quote on page 373 of my book, one of this leading, now discredited, but still global warming advocate, leading climate scientist said, "I don't think the majority of climate scientists think this, that it's over." Okay, questions coming up pretty soon. So now I've got to look at this chart that I had up here. Now, I reproduced a chart of temperatures. This is 1850, 1860, 1880, 1900, 1920, 1940, 1960, 1980, 2000. This is from a climate scientist in Australia, Joanna Nova. And she said, look, there was a warming trend. I'm just kind of roughly looking at this chart now. From about 1855 to 1875, and then a cooling trend from 1875 to about 1910, and then a warming trend from about 1910 to 1940, and then a cooling trend from 1940 to 1975, 78, and then a warming trend from 78 to 99 or 2000, and then from 2000 to 2006, and even 2009, to project it further, there was another cooling trend. But what she's saying is there's an up and down trend. And you say, well, wait a minute, this third arrow is higher than the other arrow. But these are just, it's like a half a degree centigrade higher. It's very, very tiny because the chart is so big. So there's not a lot of variation. And the other thing is, when did we get a large increase in carbon dioxide? In the industrial growth that came particularly after World War II. So if you see, these two increases were prior to any significant increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So how do you explain that? Oh, well, it happened for some other reason. Well, then how do you know this didn't happen for some other reason? If some other reason worked here, why doesn't some other reason work here? Oh, well, I don't know. And might the reason be varying sun activity for one reason? And maybe a lot of other factors. Weather is incredibly complex. And then if you have an increase, if I just take my pointer here and say, all right, let's say I've got an increase starting 1945 and going up to the present, continual increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It goes like this. Well, why during some of that time does the temperature go down? Then other times it goes up, and then it goes down again. And right when that ClimateGate scandal came out last year, England was covered by more snow than it had in decades. I thought maybe that is an ironic divine exclamation point over the ClimateGate scandal. Okay, let me kind of, as Jack is reminding me, to wind up here so we can do some interaction. Next paragraph, are glaciers melting and sea levels rising? Well, even if so, it could be due to variation in sun activity, ocean currents, and long-term weather cycles. But point three at the bottom of point three, Roman numeral three, glaciers have been shrinking slowly since the end of the last ice age, which some people say is about 18,000 years ago. No current data show accelerated shrinkage due to increased warming. Short-term observations don't prove anything. Ice melts in warmer seasons and freezes in colder seasons. So if you see these pictures of big chunks of ice splitting off an iceberg, maybe that's summer. And if you see a polar bear jumping off an ice floe, maybe that's summer too. And maybe that polar bear has been doing that for years. And maybe he enjoys swimming in that water. I don't know, and maybe he's fishing. And so pictures of melting Arctic ice prove nothing. In fact, I don't know if I have this. The Arctic ice increased at a rate of 31% Arctic ice in 2009. And in 2008, Antarctica set a record for the maximum amount of ice since monitoring began in 1979. In other words, 2008, Antarctica had more ice than it's had since the amount of ice has begun, was started to be measured in 1979, which is 30 years. The last 30 years, Antarctica has more ice than ever. So, hey, there's more ice when it gets colder. There's less ice when it gets warmer. It goes back and forth. I don't think there's any big problem. Sea levels have been rising a bit, but not the 20-foot increase that Al Gore claims in an Inconvenient Truth. In fact, Al Gore's movie was banned from British government schools because of wrongful propaganda being shown to students unless it was shown with proper refutation of its serious scientific errors. All right, page 4. Benefits from increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. I've talked about that. Would help the plants. The next paragraph, government control of energy means unacceptable loss of human freedom. And I'll go to the last point there, Roman numeral 5. Václav Klaus, the president of the Czech Republic, actually he spoke here at the Goldwater Institute in Phoenix just a couple of years ago, and he's a trained economist. And he's in his 70s, and he's lived through communism for many, many years. He says that environmental movement and the global warming alarmism is the most dangerous threat to human freedom since communism. That's a big deal. He's lived through it. He knows it. And the unacceptable costs of reducing our use of carbon fuels. Abundant, affordable energy is crucial to economic production. If you start shutting down how much energy people use, you harm an economy. And it costs everybody. Using energy sources increases work efficiency of humans, and it makes possible all human economic progress, and it allows us to use our time in higher levels of intellectual endeavor. If you see a dishwasher advised as or advertised as energy saving, you should just think work producing. Or time taking. That is, we got a different dishwasher, and it says it saves energy, but it takes 4 hours to wash the dishes. Use of energy saves us work and time. Fossil fuels, along with nuclear energy, are the most abundant and affordable sources of energy available. Alternative sources of energy like wind and solar cost 2 to 8 times as much. Too much for poor people to afford. If we care about alleviating poverty as Christians, we can't ignore the huge economic harm that would come from forcing reduction in carbon-based energy sources. And then I have a statement I signed by the Cornwall Alliance called A Renewed Call to Truth, Prudence, and Protection of the Poor, an Evangelical Examination of the Theology, Science, and Economics of Global Warming. Summary, the warnings about dangerous man-made global warming are based on poor scientific evidence, I think, and poor scientific method, are not proven by previous empirical data. They conflict with the Bible's teaching about the nature of the earth and man's purpose on the earth, and they propose solutions that would cripple the world's economies and bring immense harm to the poor. So it is a matter of significant concern. Now, maybe you want to disagree with me or interact in some ways. We've got about 10 minutes left for that. E.G., where is my microphone? Sorry, Ron. I didn't look where you were. I looked at the other side of the room. Here it comes.
I'm trying to speak loud enough.
Here's the microphone.
Okay. Talk about this cost. Within the last week, I saw an article in the Republic about APS, Arizona yep. Power Service. And they're applying right now, any of you, which is probably most of you, have APS as their electrical supplier. And I think, I don't remember the numbers, but I think like your bill each month has $3.65 added to the bill to satisfy the state's requirement of how much power they produce from these alternative sources.
Wow. And to subsidize, say,
yeah, right.
producing energy from wind or solar.
Yes.
Okay.
And so they're applying to increase that $3.65 to like $4.30
wow.
or $4.50.
Wow.
So that directly relates to this point.
Yep. $35 to $60 per household per year being spent on a wrongful scientific
yes.
hypothesis.
So we're paying for it.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Oh, this is good. It'll produce green energy, but it'll cost you a lot more. Wow. Okay. Yep, Ed. Go ahead, Ed.
You got government subsidies on top of that, so it's costing us a lot more than $35 to $60.
There's probably federal tax money that's going into that, too, so maybe it's costing us $100 a year. Who knows? Tammy?
Two things. I lived in 1979 in North Carolina on a military base, on base housing, and they came in and fixed our heater at 55 degrees during the day, it was like 59 or 60 degrees at night, and we had a newborn, and you do not want the government telling you where you can set your thermostat.
Wow.
And this was under Jimmy Carter.
Maybe 65 degrees during the day.
I don't think it was. We bought a house at 13.5% interest to get out of base housing
wow.
in order to be able to have a house
warm
enough
yeah.
Yeah, for our child. Then the second
wow.
thing is, what is your opinion on these evangelicals? I'm thinking of one in particular in California who really profess global warming and are kind of, in my opinion, really off base on
evangelists
that.
for it.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I just don't see
yeah, okay.
That.
I think they're mistaken.
Yeah,
but Hemi, I take your point. You don't want the government setting your thermostat. It's just going backwards from how God wanted human beings to use the resources of the earth and enjoy its abundant productivity. It's undoing God's purposes for the earth. Yeah, Ron.
Mark. Wayne, you know the I sat with a gentleman when I was flying from Vegas back here to Phoenix, and he worked for a power company. His power company is putting in the smart meters in all the homes in Las Vegas.
Wow.
And the power company will control the temperature of your home.
Wow.
And there'll be severe fines if you exceed those levels. So it's already
wow.
occurring.
Wow. It's an issue of human freedom. It really is. And there's that struggle between government desire to control all of our lives and human beings' desire to free. And our Declaration of Independence said, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are rights that are given to us by God. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. Government should be protecting our liberties, not taking them away. No. Well, I don't know. I mean, anything else?
Nothing else. You
can sing the song. Yes. Let's see if anybody else. Yeah, way back. Way in back over there.
Pastor Jamie's sermon today talked about the crazy culture, but yesterday I received my Popular Science magazine, and the reason I figured they call it Popular Science because it's popular, not necessarily true, but the first two pages were an ad by Goldman Sachs wind energy, and this kind of brought to mind the craziness of our society. Here you've got a criminal activity like Goldman Sachs, and this leads into a correlation.
They were convicted of some wrongful activity. I don't know that the whole company
well,
is.
it's okay. You need to see the movie Inside Job. Okay. about the bank debacle here. It's on right now.
Popular Science magazine said something, though. Oh, an ad for wind energy. I go, yes. Okay, yeah.
Which is, a bogus technology.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of pressure in the culture to go this direction. And you have thousands of people who are being paid to, whose jobs depend on sort of finding evidence that supports this theory, and university researchers and United Nations money and things like that. So, okay, yeah, Jerry. Okay.
And that's where all this goes.
If people don't believe in God, they can believe in anything. Okay. Duff.
Wayne, I might have my dates not correct, but it seems to me about the 60s, there was a real alarm out about the Ice Age is coming.
Global cooling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here we are. You know,
yeah.
We've gone 180. No,
yeah, it was this section of the graph where there was sort of a downward slope. Yeah. Yeah. Mike.
Yeah, just it's a challenging political situation for us that are, real skeptical around, fossil-based fuels and the production of global warming.
Yeah.
At the same time, a recognition that politically, as a country, we probably should not be dependent upon foreign sources of energy, and which makes it prudent that we do things internally within our country to make ourselves self-sufficient. So that's an awkward balance for us. I don't know if you have a comment
that. I appreciate that, Mike. I would like us not to be so dependent on Arab nations' oil, for instance. And developing solar energy, where it's reasonable and economical, makes sense to reduce dependence on foreign oil. But it would also say we should develop domestic oil production, offshore oil, off the coast of California. I would especially like to see, I mean, that would say that the political climate has changed. And the ANWR from Alaska, and there's oil shale being, it's possible to be produced in oil from that in Colorado and other places. So I think we should support that if we can, domestic energy production. Okay, I think now I've gone way past the time we were supposed to sing. One more, and then we'll do a song.
Sorry, this may just be coincidental, but years ago when I was at Moody, I heard a secular speaker talk about with all the global warming, it could result in too many disasters and earthquakes and all that.
Yep.
And that's where I, tied the passage in with Christ, where he says, in end times, because of sin, there'll be many disasters and earthquakes. So part of me has always thought that this global warming has kind of been something to take our focus off of what the scriptures have promised.
Because
even when Haiti happened, I mentioned to a couple coworkers, and they said, oh, no, it's not sin, it's global warming.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's any tie there, but it's something I've always thought
about.
Well,
I think what you're saying is our concern about what's happening in the world should be about trying to follow and promote adherence to God's moral standards, not trying to reduce energy production, which is just harming everybody. Okay, let's end on a... Rose, I'm going to have to wait till next time you talk to me afterward. I went beyond. Okay.
Do you think that this is a way of redistributing the wealth?
Oh, is it a way of redistributing wealth? Yeah. That's a driving concern to reduce the wealth of rich nations. Yeah, okay.